Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Carol Fleming of the Board of Governors and Chair of the Member-Led Forums. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. How many of you have come home with a purchase that caused you to ask, why on earth did I buy this? Anybody else beside me? Oh, yes. Well, I think we're going to be enlightened today. Because even if this is the first time you've attended one of Kit Yarrow's speeches, you've probably heard her before on NPR, KCBS, the local news, or in the New York Times. As an award-winning consumer psychologist, Kit's frequently called on by businesses, organizations, and the media to explain and predict consumer behavior. Kit is a professor of both psychology and marketing at Golden Gate University, a consultant, and she writes about consumer issues for Time. She's the author of two books about consumer psychology, and tonight she'll share findings from her latest book, which you can find right out there in the hall, Decoding the New Consumer Mind. Yarrow will share with us surprising insights on the motivations and behaviors of today's shoppers. This is important for any marketers in the audience. Please welcome Kit Yarrow.
Thank you, Carol, and thank you all for coming. I'm so delighted to be here. So today we're going to talk about a few insights from my new book. The premise of the book is really kind of simple, that we as human beings have had the same basic human needs for all time. We need to connect with other people. We need to feel like we have purpose in life. We need to stay safe. We need to find just the right fur bikini. But the world has changed a lot, especially in the last decade. And along with the world changing, how we address those needs, how we get those needs met, has really changed as well. So what I'm going to do today, and what I've done in much more detail in my book, is talk about three really huge sociocultural shifts that have big psychological implications, and then apply those to shifts that I think marketers need to make to adjust to this new psychology. The first big shift is our use of technology. So whenever I go to marketing conferences, a lot of people are very excited about how we can shop on our mobile now and do all sorts of things with technology. And although that is really exciting and interesting, to me, the really important thing for marketers to know is how we have changed psychologically because of our use of technology. I think that we've changed both in the way that we think and also in the way that we feel and how we relate to others, what we want, what we need, the works. So, for example, if we go back 20 years, most of you would have said something like either that or gigantic woman when I asked you what the Amazon is. Today, we would think about this, and happy 20th birthday this week to Amazon. In just a couple of years, it will be the second largest retailer in the world. Most retailers took decades. They took generations to build to that level of stature, that a retailer was able to achieve that level of prominence in such a short period of time is really and truly remarkable. Just as just 20, 25 years ago, if I asked you about a web, you might have thought of a spider web, and today it's all sort of the same thing. So this ability, I think, to embrace new things and try new things is one of the big, big shifts in our psychology. So at once upon a time, I think we were afraid to try new things. We waited for those early adopters to haul it out, and then we'd copy them if we felt secure. But in general, we didn't really want new things. We had to be convinced to try new things. The opposite is true today. We not only want new things, we expect new things. And retailers and marketers that don't bring out new things are thought of as kind of like dinosaurs. The other big, huge shift, I think, related to our use of technology is a major change in how we think. So once upon a time, you know, we used to, I think, spend a long time gathering information and distilling information. That's all happened so quickly, it's changed our brains. You know, our brains are malleable, and what we use becomes stronger, and what we don't becomes less efficient. And so, basically, because of our use of technology, we want things faster. We need higher levels of stimulation in order to capture our attention. We become distracted more easily, and obviously any problems that need a lot of thinking are sort of less appealing to us today. So, for example, we get bored a lot more easily with any sort of explanation about products, about what we need to do to get ready for something. We get tired more quickly of our jobs and even our relationships. And this is truer more particularly for our younger generations. Okay, so which of these things do you think has the most profound effect on our cognitive abilities? Smoking a joint, missing a night of sleep, or multitasking? Missing a night of sleep. You're just being contrary. Right. It is indeed multitasking. And I point that out because it really does profoundly affect the way that we think and how we process information. It's one of the reasons why the amount of news that it takes for us to be convinced that something is true is expanded so greatly, because the way we consume news today is in tiny little bits and bytes, 140 characters here, a comment there, a little blip of information there. We sort of graze throughout getting our news, and so we require a lot more of it in order to believe that something is true. In 2005, it was two sources, and today it's five sources. The same is also true with our friendships. Once upon a time, we had a couple of really good friends. They were full and complete in our lives. The average American, in fact, in the 60s had 3.8 friends, and today they have fewer than two. Today we have 140, 350, 990, you know, monumental numbers of friends, but they're much more superficial friendships. And this is, again, for every generation, this becomes a more profound change in how we relate to other people. So this is one of the effects of that. Uh-oh, our sound's not working. Can I have the wizards back up here for a moment? Calling the wizards. Here they come. Okay. Well, you actually almost don't need to hear the sound. You get it. So in the first 6 months that this video was posted on YouTube, with no publicity or advertising of any sort, it garnered 20 million views. It obviously resonates with people, right? It means something. I think people are really suffering and struggling with this, and it's part of another shift, I think, brought about by our use of technology, which is kind of a quantity over quality way of connecting, which, if we go back to the caveman slide, is not what's really nurturing to people. People really need to feel like they're connecting with others, and so I think they're doing other things to kind of make up for it. It's also, of course, provided us with a lot of really excellent jokes. If you can't see the caption, it keeps me from looking at my phone every 2 seconds. The second big shift I want to talk about in our psychology is really a trend away from a more collectivistic society to a more individualistic society, a focus on me rather than we. So one of the subjects that I interviewed for my book told me that he used to go to the San Francisco Farmers Market, probably a lot of you have as well, every weekend, and he stopped going because everybody's on their phone all the time, and it's like playing, I love this quote, it's like playing bumper cars. But part of what he's expressing is not just the inconvenience of crowds or the fact that people run into because they're using their phones. I think it's a sense of isolation that comes when people don't connect and look at each other. So I think one of the trends that we're experiencing with consumers and what I'm hearing from consumers is that they feel sort of alone, partly because there's a lot less eye contact. And there's tons of psychological studies that point out the great importance of connecting even with people that you aren't going to ever see again, like the barista at the coffee shop, and making you feel good about yourself and good about your community and a participant in the world. I think that's part of why we have this sort of bubbling sense of rancor. It's one of many reasons. I think there's a lot of reasons why people are telling me that they feel like the world is a more difficult place, that there's a more combative dialogue going on. Does anybody here think that the world is a kinder, gentler place than it was 10 years ago? I was hoping maybe I could have some of that if you did. No? Okay. So that's what I'm hearing, is that it is a really much more difficult work. And I think part of that is because of the lack of connection that people feel to each other, partly because we're engaged with our phones rather than engaged with each other. And so we're actually even moving away from collectivistic to individualistic to almost being a more polarized society. In dialogue that we hear in the media and in politics, instead of hearing, I disagree with you, or even that's a stupid idea, instead what we hear are things like, you're stupid. So it's become extremely personalized, which again just raises the level of rancor out there. And it's one of the reasons why airlines reported 500 incidents of bad behavior on the part of travelers in 2007, and this past year they reported 8,000. So obviously consumers are also misbehaving out there. Another reason why we're moving towards this more individualistic society is because we share fewer things. So, not making a judgment about this, having lots of choice and the ability to customize your news and, you know, to socialize with whoever is exactly the same as you, you know, that can be wonderful from time to time. But the sense of community that people have by knowing their neighbors and knowing their neighborhood, by sharing cultural experiences or reading the same newspapers, again, you know, not to put a value judgment on that, but I do know that it makes people feel less connected to each other. We also don't really need each other in the fundamental survival way that we used to. You know, once upon a time, you really kind of had to connect with other people or you would die. We're all descendants of cavemen who were able to form groups in order to protect themselves, go and gather wood and clothing and food and procreate and so on. And so, you know, we're kind of meant to work cooperatively, but we don't have to today. You know, you basically can be completely alone all the time and survive today. So the self-reliance that we have has another side effect, which is, in fact, I think, less dependency on others, which exacerbates our sense of autonomy. Another side effect of our more individualistic society and also our use of technology is that we feel more powerful. So you can sell what you want on eBay today. In fact, most consumers think about the resale value of products that they're buying before they purchase them. That never happened before. You can have your own company today. Justin Bieber circumvented all the traditional hierarchies to become a rising star, and so did Kate Upton. So the next year she was also on Sports Illustrated, and then just this last year now she's a movie star, and if you don't like eBay, you can go to RealReal, and well, we know what happened to Justin. It wasn't pretty. But nevertheless, people see those stories about empowerment, and they themselves feel empowered. And so it's kind of changing the dynamic of consumers away from more passive to much more powerful. They're starting their own companies. 38% of millennials have their own business, whether it's doing something on the side of a regular job or whether it's just finding a way to sell their hobby, like this person who's knitting really unusual things. Anyway, God bless them. They get to do it, and they get to make money off of it. I assume there are other turtles that would like to have a cozy. So when we're marketing to this more empowered consumer, obviously they're less aspirational than they used to be. You know, the idea that if you bought a particular product, you could be viewed a particular way is kind of dead. You know, today what consumers are is wanting to be admired. They have the power. They don't need it from a brand, and that's a really different dynamic in marketing. The last big psychological shift I want to talk about before we get into some of the marketing tactics is more emotionality. So people in general feel a little less secure, a little less in control, and a little less connection to other people, and that's raised a sense of anger and anxiety in society. If you don't believe me, the Edelman Trust Barometer lists these numbers. They might be too small on that screen for you to see, but this is how Americans rated their belief in leadership. So they have basically no belief in our government. That's the green line, to be able to be honest, ethical, and solve problems. Slightly higher, but still frankly abysmal, trust in business leaders in the same realms. In general, Americans just don't trust anymore. And if you think that that's just, you know, the older people feeling that way, it's even more profoundly true for Gen Yers. So in that chart, which probably you can't see the figures on as well, Gen Yers were, all generations were asked, generally speaking, would you say that most people can be trusted or that you can't be too careful? And Gen Yers, even more than the others, feel like you can't be too careful, that most people can't be trusted. So we have this much more wary and guarded consumer walking around out there. So who do they trust? I mean, we have to trust and connect with somebody. They trust themselves, and they're empowered at the same time to do that. And they trust people they perceive to be like them, which is one of the reasons why people increasingly gravitate toward online reviews as a way to feel like they can trust and believe in a company or a product. They also trust in bargains. This isn't just because of the recession. People gravitate towards bargains as a way to feel sure that they're not being taken advantage of, that marketers aren't stealing from them. They use bargains as a way to understand that value in some way exists within that product. So bargains in general, when I interview consumers, are really not that much about money. It's really more about kind of an emotional assurance. Okay, so now let's move on to anxiety. The J. Walter Thompson Anxiety Index that just came out this year shows that 3/4 of Americans feel anxious, as opposed to the 1/4 who are blissfully free of anxiety. Now, anxiety affects a lot of characteristics about us, but most notably how we make decisions. So when we feel anxious, we actually process information differently. This is how we do it on shopping. So we started out developing anxiety as a protective mechanism from things like bears. So we feel a little bit afraid, we feel wary, we feel protective about things that could kill us. And today, however, it's not bears that are the source of anxiety and fear. It's really more these emotional products, but never emotional characteristics. Feeling unsafe in the world, feeling unconnected or unnurtured, a lot of the things we just spoke about. And so, unfortunately, though, our bodies and minds still react as if there's a bear there, which means that we're taking energy and focus away from our thinking parts of our mechanism and moving it towards the physical parts. In other words, we're preparing to run from the bear. We're preparing to fight. Our heart rates go up. Our hands get a little sweaty. Our eyes dilate. And even if it's just a tiny little bit of a shift away from logical into our physiological protective system, it affects what happens when we go shopping. And it's one of the reasons why I think smart marketers everywhere are really putting a lot of emphasis on the way that people experience and their offerings. All of the senses are now being looked at a little bit more carefully, and if they're not, they really should be. Let me give you an example. Assuming that all of my girls here had a head, which one do you think might get higher tips than the other ones? Anybody read the book? You already know. Do you think red? Anybody else? The pink. Pink gets a lot of votes, I found. Right. Yes, in fact, our red girl is going to get 16% to 24% higher tips just for wearing a red uniform. Now, this study was done brilliantly. Same day of the week, same uniform, just different colors, same clientele. All the variables were constant. The only thing that changed was the color of the uniform. And yes, if you were wearing a red one, you got 16 to 24% higher tips. And I'm going to tell you now who gives higher tips, and you'll know what the secret is. Only from men. Women don't give higher tips. Because red is a very symbolic color to men, right? I see a couple guys going, is it? I had no idea. Seriously, need to get a red dress, see how that works for my talks from now on. And if you're wearing red lipstick, you get even higher tips. So the visual punch of color is really communicated in this study. If you're eating biscuits in a room that smells like lemons, you are tidier than if you're eating biscuits in a room that's unscented. Another one of my favorite studies. So we're just reacting to the scent and what the emotional meaning of the scent is, which is clean, and then we change our behavior accordingly. But just like with the waitresses, the subjects in this study don't acknowledge that they're doing anything differently. We aren't aware of how our body is really influencing our mind in these situations. If you're holding a rock, when you're giving a performance review, watch out. No, you'll rate that candidate worse than if you're holding a pillow. And if you're holding a hot pad, when you're considering buying ballpoint pens, you're willing to spend about 20% more than if you're holding a cold pad. All of these studies I checked, they're really beautifully done. They all make, you know, there's no flaws in the instrument there. But it just shows, I think, the power of our unconscious mind and of symbolic cues in influencing why we buy what we buy. The shopper there who has to go through a little plastic thing in order to get her pastries will spend longer and may leave than if it was an open case. So anytime we have to do something, even though it's not even strenuous, like reach up high or low or go through a case or open a door in the freezer section, there's less likelihood that we'll buy that product than if it's right in front of us and in the center of our vision. It's why grocery stores have open case freezers now, because they know there's that impediment to purchase there. So in general, with these three huge psychological shifts, what we know is that the past is really no longer prologue. We can't predict the future based on the how consumers have reacted in the past. They've changed really in every way. And so these shifts that I've mentioned all kind of reinforce each other. There's a way where, you know, it becomes almost like a snowball effect. And hopefully I've given you enough information that you believe me. There's lots more in my book that consumers have changed, and they're psychologically different. And so I can move on to what marketers need to do about it. Ready? All righty, here we go. All right. So first, let me tell you the story about the talking dog. Anybody heard the story of the talking dog? Okay, good. There are a lot of them, yeah. All right. So this guy's driving along the road, and he sees a sign that says talking dog, $10. And he says, okay, gal, who's going to pass that up? I got to check this one out. So he pulls over, goes up to the guy in the front of the house, and he goes, are you kidding me? You've got a talking dog? And the guy says, yeah, I do. You can go check him out. He's in the backyard. So he goes into the back, and he sees this beautiful black lab, and he goes, is it true? Can you talk? And the lab says, oh, yeah, I can talk. In fact, I was a spy for most of my life because people don't believe a dog can talk. So I was able to sit in on secretive meetings and really discover things and then report back. And so, you know, I'm responsible for a lot of safety in the United States because I've been an awesome spy. So I did this for a few years, and then I felt like it was time to have some puppies. So I retired and settled down, and I had my puppies. And, you know, and then it just seemed like the world was getting more and more unsafe. So I went back into service again and became an undercover dog and a spy. And really, you know, you hear, I don't know if you saw that TV show I did where that woman was claiming that she was responsible for bin Laden's capture and death. I was. It was me. I did all of that. Because again, being a talking dog, you can get away with a lot. And that's where I am today. So the guy goes, are you kidding me? You want $10 for this dog? And the owner says, yeah, he's a liar. He didn't do any of that stuff. So the point of that to me is the very mistake that so many marketers make. They get really fixated on one little thing, like using mobile, or they get really excited about just omnichannel, or just, you know, there's a new trick and a new trend that comes down the bend every day, and marketers are just, they've got the hardest job in the world because they're just flooded with all of these tactics. And to me, I think that's the thing you have to resist, is just jumping on tactics, but to remain strategic. And I think that starts with a really good understanding of the psychology of consumers. So with that sort of caveat, before I go into some tactics and strategies, you know, keep in mind that these aren't for everybody. They're just some ideas to whet your appetite and get you thinking. So the premise of the first one is that people really want to be involved and seen today. You know, we live at a time where everybody gets their say, but nobody's really heard. And so the blessing of being heard, you know, the gift of being seen really resonates with consumers today. Plus, they want to be involved. You know, once upon a time, marketers would come up with something good, and then they'd say, this product is really good, and here's why. You should buy it. And that worked because we didn't have a lot of options. We didn't have that empowerment. Today, what involves is what works better is when consumers do the talking for you. So, for example, Kleenex had a Share the Kindness campaign that was massively successful where you could go on their website or Facebook page and have a little package of Kleenex sent to a friend of yours that was sick. So that was a terrific sampling program. Kleenex would have bought a list at one point and sent tissues to people that didn't necessarily even want them. But this program's loaded with emotion. It's directed by consumers. Everybody feels good, and it's a true involvement story. There's lots of ways of connecting, and conveniently, most of them begin with C, so they're easy to remember. So let me go through a few of these really quickly, and of course, I go into a lot more detail in my book. Basically, everybody knows the tools of champions. If you want to get people to champion your brand, if you want to get people to champion your product, they now have social media tools that allow them to do it. It's almost like any individual can be a news medium in effect. And so courting champions and people that will do the talking for you is just a can't-miss situation since businesses don't have credibility anymore, since consumers want to hear from other consumers, and because the consumers that are doing the talking actually want to do the talking. They want to be the star. They want to be the influencers. Here's another example. Uh-oh, music, oh, sound died again. Oh, there we go. So this is for a water company, but the point is that if you get something enticing enough like that, you don't even need a media budget. People will just send it around. And it's not just the people that participated in this that walked by and wanted to ride their bikes. It's the viral effect of having great media, whether it's YouTube or Twitter or Facebook or, you know, and it doesn't even have to be funny or humorous. It can be just educational and informative at some point, sometimes. Uh-oh, here comes the wizard. Nope, we're good. Okay. The most credible source is your employee. So when employees talk about their company, their manufacturer, their retailer, this is an enormous source of credibility. I really like this campaign that AAA of Northern California came out with. And I also put this one in the book because, again, they're championing their employees, which makes them look like a good employer, which builds trust. And the words aren't theirs. They're the words of the employees, which, again, all of this kind of comes together to be the right mindset for today's more wary, guarded, and distrustful consumer. Crowdsourcing is another method that really works, whether you're asking consumers to design potato chips for you. Just getting them involved and asking for their input and asking for their opinion is the courtship that works today. If they can get together and redesign a skid steer backhoe thing, they can help you with whatever product. But it's not even just, I think, the idea that you're going to come out with a better product. It's the idea that when people help, they have a sense of ownership. And by the way, these are the brands in the Lay's potato chip contest that won in other countries. I just got such a kick out of thinking about that sausage-flavored or pickled cucumber chip. Contests of all sorts are, again, the sort of involvement that makes consumers passionate about your brand. And you might think, you know, not everybody plays contests, but 80% of people play contests. They really like them. They really like that sort of sense of engagement and potential winning. Another thing you can do is crowdfund some particular new aspect of your product. So Sarah Oliver handbags, and there's Sarah Oliver right there, and there's one of our Pearlettes right there too, right? So when they wanted to expand into a bridal line, they probably could have come up with the funds to do that, but having it crowdfunded through Kickstarter created a sense of involvement and passion in consumers that I think really catapulted the brand in that way. So one of the people that I spoke with that had contributed to the crowdfunding said, "We did it. I can't believe we did it." And this is what I hear from people when they talk about crowdfunded campaigns is ownership. And that sense of ownership translates to a mouthpiece in presenting your brand to others once people feel like they're involved in it. The next big shift, I think, I'm going to use popcorn as an example for. So once upon a time, this is how you got popcorn. You put it on the stove in a pan and popped away, right? Well, that was laborious and tedious, and plus there were dishes to do. So now we got the microwave popcorn. 3 minutes, ready to go, hot, fresh, and delicious, right? Not fast enough for today's consumers. The highest growth in popcorn consumption is in already popped. So to me, this is a great example of what consumers really expect today, which is everything faster, everything more intense, everything more ramped up. Whatever amount of time it took before, it might seem reasonable to you, but to your consumers, I can't accentuate enough how important it is that they feel stimulated, engaged, you know, and more involved and faster, harder, better all the time is the new norm in marketing. So I look at lots of opportunities for marketers, and here's sort of a shorthand cheat sheet of some of the ways you can do it. But generally speaking, if you think I need to add something in, I need to ramp it up by giving them something more, you're on the right track. So it could be a limited time promotion, you know, only for a weekend, only for 6 hours, only for 2 hours, limited location, you can only get it here. A local retailer, a charity tie-in as well, some sort of good story, but you gotta give them something more. Just a good product isn't enough today. Consumers wanna be stimulated in a way that they haven't in the past because that bar is so much higher than it ever was in the past. So the panty party here is my favorite example. Once upon a time, you could get people to come to your promotion by saying that you were gonna give everybody that showed up a new free t-shirt. That would get nobody to come to your promotion today. So this company here said, okay, the first 100 people to come to our promotion in their panties and bras will get an entire outfit. And of course, in every city they did this, it was a party and people lined up around the block. It was massive news media events. And that's what I mean by ramped up. Not just a t-shirt, but make it an event, make it big, ask for more from your consumers and give them more in return. I think it's also why food trucks and pop-up stores and roving cigar bars and Amazon's drone delivery are so fascinating consumers because the last hurdle is really delivery. I mean, I think delivery and the concept of when I get it is the, you know, the next big frontier in marketing differentiation. The third big shift I want to talk about is the importance of getting real, how you need to overcome that trust deficit. You know, once upon a time, marketers just had to not lose the trust that was assumed. And today, you start from behind, and you have to earn trust from consumers. It's part of why the family-owned, handcrafted, small-batch movement is so powerful today, because it seems more trustworthy than big business. It's part of why transparency is talked about so often. So whether it's the fees that you charge for a t-shirt that you make or the fees that are charged in banking, if you're not doing anything wrong, just be honest about it. And if you're doing something wrong, probably you should rethink your business plan anyway. One of my favorite examples, though, is McDonald's.
While that burger was made in about a minute or so, the process we go through on the average shoot takes several hours. And here I think it's important to note that all the ingredients that Noah uses are the exact same ingredients that we use in the restaurant. So it's the exact same patties, it's the exact same ketchup and mustard and onions and the exact same buns. Almost ready for you, Neil.
Hey, Neil.
We want to be able to show the pickles and the condiments as we build.
Right.
In the store, they would naturally just line it up straight in line.
Yep.
We have to bring it back a little bit to reveal the fact that it comes with the pickles and the slivered onions.
Because we're in a one-dimensional world mm-hmm. in the camera, everything's in the back in the picture. I don't know what's actually in it.
Right.
This way we can at least tell people, you have ketchup, you have mustard, you have two pieces of cheese, and you know what you're getting.
Perfect onion selection. It's like you're a surgeon in there.
Because we've had to put things forward, the bun is sitting crooked. So he's just compensating.
So if I'm just melting down the cheese with my palette knife,
maybe I'll put mustard, ketchup, actually ketchup, mustard, ketchup. Ready?
Yep.
Oh,
that's
beautiful.
Nice.
This burger looks pretty good as is. I don't think it's going to need much retouching whatsoever. Let me introduce you to Stuart Murray. He's going to take the side-by-side comparison and do a little finessing of the product. Less amount of retouching that we do to something, the less perfect it looks, but actually it looks more appetizing and more convincing. But just enhancing some color, taking out some of the little accents that might happen in preparation, which obviously doesn't show the product in its best possible light. Here you can definitely see that there's a size difference, the box that our sandwiches come in. Keep the sandwiches warm, so it creates a bit of a steam effect, and it does make the bun contract a little bit. And then the main difference is the fact that we actually took all the ingredients that are normally hidden under the bun and we pulled them to the foreground so that you can see them. And those are the main differences. So, Isabel, thank you so much for your question. We hope that's answered it for you. Thanks.
So people can write into McDonald's with questions and then they'll answer them on videos and post them on YouTube. And, you know, what I love about this is the really non-defensive, kind of not guilty way that they answered the question. Because if you're acting kind of defensive about things, you know, well, the bun shrunk, then people just assume you're doing something wrong, right? So I think, you know, why would they want to showcase a bad burger? They want it to look as good as it can. So people can write in with any question, as I mentioned, and apparently somebody wrote in and said, do you have a company that's called Real Beef so that you can serve us stuff that's not beef and still say it's real beef? So I think McDonald's also must enjoy being able to address some of the rumors that go around out there. Another example I love was a consumer that I spoke with who used to buy Hermes scarves and then just put the brakes on it and said, I'm being ripped off. I'm being taken advantage of. I don't trust them anymore. They're $400 now. That's just crazy. And then she went to a little traveling road show that Hermes put on where they showed how the scarves are hand screened and rolled and so on. And she went right out and bought one that day. And she said, you know, now that I understand what goes into them, I think they're actually a bargain, which was shocking. But still, it works for her. And Burberry and a lot of luxury retailers are doing a very good job of sort of explaining the value of something along with a history and a heritage. Companies that make mistakes and apologize are actually rated higher than companies that don't make mistakes by those same consumers, which is not to suggest you should go out and make mistakes, but really more I think it showcases how important humanity and honesty are to consumers. All around Europe, people are there's a new gimmick going on in coffee shops where if you want a coffee, say, it's $5. But if you say, please, it's $4. And if you say, may I have a coffee, please, it's $3. So I don't know if that would work as well here, However, the idea that a brand and a retailer are kind of showcasing their values through their pricing strategy does resonate with consumers, because consumers are actually looking at brands and retailers as more human than they ever have been before. They're looking for human characteristics, which explains these next couple of ads I'm going to show you.
You only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go.
I have to avert my eyes because I cry every time. I think I've seen it 20 times and I can't look. Yes, Carol, this is the Budweiser ad that ran during the Super Bowl. And, you know, the Super Bowl has a lot of metrics for measuring favorites and so on. And this just everywhere, every how, number one most popular ad. Here's another popular product, Kind Bars. Kind Bars are in a product that's loaded with 2,000 health and nutrition bars, and they have 6 of the top 10 bars, and it's a really new product. And frankly, they're good, but they're not that different from a lot of bars that are out there. So what's up with Kind Bars? Why are they carried in college bookstores and Jamba Juice and airport lounges and a lot of places where they don't carry bars at all? Why do you think? I think it's the name. I think it also has something to do with why Life is Good has taken off. This is a campaign, it's a product where everything is built around optimism. That's the main message and theme that the owners of this company, two brothers, kind of set out was life is good, and they're fishing and hunting and doing all sorts of things, but it's a message of optimism. And again, it kind of went from a college activity to 3,500 stores around the world and major markets everywhere. It's been a huge success. And one more ad.
Shit my pants. Right here? Shit my pants, you're kidding.
You can ship your pants? Right here.
You hear that? I can ship my pants for free.
Wow, I just may ship my pants.
Yeah, ship your pants. Billy, you can ship your pants too.
I can't wait to ship my pants, Dad.
I just shipped my pants and it's very convenient.
Very convenient.
I just shipped my drawers.
I just shipped my nightie.
I just shipped my bed.
If you can't find what you're looking for in store, we'll find it at Kmart.com right now and ship it to you for free.
That group hug at the end is really essential to this ad. It brings it all together, and it communicates, I think, a lot of what people are looking for, which is the antidote to a lot of that rancor and sense of polarization that people feel. They want to feel like there's kindness and optimism and caring and human connection and happiness in the world, and they're gravitating towards products that represent that. And if you don't believe me, last year the 50 brands with the strongest financial growth all were associated with positive personality characteristics. I think there's a dire human need for that that's translated through what people buy. The next big thing I want to recommend is to communicate to be heard and really kind of change the way that you use words, as in don't use them. Just move on to visuals. I know that, you know, the legal department will have their say and there'll have to be some blah blah in there anyway, but try to sequester it in some way or explain that you have to do it. And kind of move around to being more positive, more future-oriented, more reward-oriented, much shorter communication in more frequent bursts. More benefit-driven. There's a reason why Skinny Cow and Skinny Margaritas and Skinny Pop are all successful, and Diet Cow, Diet Margarita, and Diet Anything is not successful, because diet is a product characteristic that sounds bad, but skinny is a product benefit that sounds good and fun and optimistic. So, I mean, we've been saying this for a long time in marketing, the importance of shifting away from attributes to benefits, but there's never been a more important time to do it than now.
Yeah, but you wouldn't, but you, it ended up not being, it was actually what it was.
Oh, yeah,
and then it,
right.
You could, oh, it was like, he, you, was oh, no, he? No, okay, I know what it was.
Right.
It's like,
so,
it's, you, oh, gosh, it was awesome.
So we know we've got to shorten it up. We know that we've got to be more benefit-driven. And I hope that this is proof that we have to be more visual in the way we communicate. It's what consumers are doing as well. They're really using pictures and words in order to talk to each other. Facebook posts that don't contain pictures are not read anymore. Remember when Facebook started? It was all about just typing in what you were doing. Now, if you don't have a picture, nobody's paying attention, and the same is true for marketing. We really communicate with each other in ways that are so much more visual, and that's how people want to process information. So if you're a Caribou Coffee and you have something where you can make it look like your kids are steaming away in a coffee cup, imagine how many Christmas cards or holiday letters or Facebook posts that picture went on advertising Caribou Coffee in each one. Pinterest, I think the runaway success of that has so much to do with the fact that it's just visuals, that all you do is like visuals, and you communicate who you are and what you want and who you're connecting with through a completely visual language. Actions are speaking so much louder than words. So when Range Rover sends one of their vehicles to the North Pole and another one to ride across the desert and they track their progress on YouTube, people are going to watch that and understand what the vehicle is all about in a much more effective way than anything Range Rover could say about their durability, about their effectiveness as a vehicle. Actions are definitely louder than words. And it's also, this is a little bit more mundane example, but people just love these videos. So, you know, people just gravitate towards Lowe's now as the expert in home improvement because they have videos that show you what to do with their products. None of these are marketing vehicles except for the guy's always wearing his little Lowe's branded jacket. But it's just instructional videos that make Lowe's both the authority and also connect emotionally the consumer to the brand. You can rub off images much more easily today. There's a reason why Red Bull was the sixth most commonly listed sponsor of the Olympics, and yet they didn't sponsor the Olympics at all. All these people that sponsored the Olympics weren't even listed, but Red Bull was, because they constantly associate themselves with extreme sports. They're on Fearless Felix when he plunges from the sky. They're on fabulous skateboarders and snowboarders, and they have so earned that reputation through this kind of rub-off. And what I mean by that is that we kind of unconsciously associate images and believe that there's a connection. It doesn't really ever go through the thinking part of our brain. We never think to ourselves, oh, look at Red Bull, what they're doing. We just feel a particular way through those visual associations. And it's why Marc Jacobs and Isaac Mizrahi can design packages today, because they need to come down a little bit and feel more accessible, and because Coke and Kleenex really benefit from the elevation of their association with the designers. The last tip I have is to technovate. So that's my kind of hybrid word that mashes together technology and innovation. And the meaning here is that if you're not incorporating new, you're just old. You're not relevant. Unless you're retro chic, which is also new, new is dead. Old is dead. You've got to constantly be innovating. And the more you incorporate technology into your innovation, the more relevant you are to consumers, because they're incorporating technology into their lives. A few examples: you can incorporate technology into your products, like the Barbie makeover mirror that uses an iPad instead of the hinky stuff they used to use back in the day. Being able to shop on a Saturday at a store, having cookbooks in Google Glass or whatever new technology is coming out. You know, finding a way where you may possibly incorporate your product into that. It can be the product itself improved. It can be the retail shopping experience improved. It can be the website improved. Restaurants that have the wine list on an iPad are just going to be looked at as more relevant and cool than those that don't. And consumers want that information today. It also solves one of the biggest problems that retailers and marketers tell me they have today, which is terrible customer service, that it's really difficult to train and maintain quality customer service. And it's from the consumers that I interview, it's the number one source of hell for them in relating to retailers in particular, the horrible customer service stories that they keep and hold and that change their perception of brands and retailers. And it is also a completely missed opportunity in that it's the number one source of love that I hear from consumers. When they do get great service, oh my God, they're so happy, they're so surprised, they're so loyal, they're so eager to tell people, and the bar is so low. You just can't help but win. So if you have a kiosk with an iPad that can answer some questions, you know, more consumers than not say they'd rather consult their own technology than talk to a salesperson that doesn't have all the information anyway. So help them out with apps and iPads and solve some of the customer service problems that are out there. One of my students at FIT was talking about the future of beauty and said, you know, it's just a question of time where you'll be walking down the street, you'll see a color that you like, you'll take a picture of it with your phone, and then you'll tap that phone and you'll be able to order that particular shade of eyeshadow or nail polish. And now, after we've just seen what the fire has to offer, it looks like that's not so far in the future. But any sort of way that you can incorporate technology to make life easier makes a lot of sense. Most businesses are kind of arranged around silos. The online version is different from the in-store version, the physical product from the technology. And, you know, that's the number one wish of consumers, that those would be a little bit more integrated, that all the things they love about the online world be brought into a shopping experience and vice versa. So you can't wait. And I use Uber as my favorite example of this. The taxi industry kind of resting on its laurels, sort of figuring there's no competition, so who cares, all regulated. And along comes Uber and completely transforms the private transportation market. So fast, our heads are still spinning because of it. They give consumers a sense of control with that they really want. You get to watch the little car coming in. That is the thing that consumers talk to me about more than anything, is that they like knowing, is it coming? Is it going to be here? They like being able to do it themselves on their phone without necessarily talking to people, and on and on. But all of these consumer needs, a company, you guys all know Uber, I'm assuming, you know, taxi service. If you don't, you need to get it. So I think the point I'd like to make with this one, though, is that it happened in 20 minutes when the taxi company was sitting around thinking that they had it made. So whatever business you're in, unless you're really thinking about it now, you're making a mistake. If you wait until customers tell you, you're too late. They expect you to figure it out and then let them know what they want and show them what they need. And I have time for just a couple of questions, but first, let's dance.
Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof.
Okay, you can stop now. Thank you. Okay, we'll watch Darby Farrell. Who's got a question? Mr. McLaughlin.
I have a question. Of all the things that you mentioned that makes for a good retailer, the only one I think that Costco does is the last one with good service. How do they do it? I mean, how do they succeed and how they're so successful?
That's such a good question. So the question was, how does Costco do it? They aren't technovating very much, but in fact they are. They do have prices. They're an adventure when you go shopping. I think people look at the never knowing if it's going to be there or not as kind of the plus one thing that, you know, it's that when you stumble across something at Costco, it's like finding a treasure. And in that limited sort of time, limited location characteristic is really exciting to consumers. And I think the assurance and trust that comes from feeling like there's consistently low prices, like you'd never have to worry whether or not it's going to be higher than someplace else. All of those things put together make Costco a really stellar shopping experience for most consumers. Thank you. Good question. Yes.
Thank you, Kit. My name is Colleen, and I'm actually here as an aspiring social entrepreneur, and I'm here to tackle the issue of overconsumption. And I hate to break everybody's happy-go-lucky bubble that was talked here today, but actually, behind every product, there's a huge environmental and social impact.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a question?
I do.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure it wasn't going to get derailed.
No. Just one fact, and then I'll give the question.
Okay.
If every person in this world consumed like the average American, mm-hmm. it would be the equivalent of 77 billion people on this planet. So I guess my question for you is, I didn't see it as part of your shifts on the list, and I would just like to know if you have any experience with consumers wanting to know more about those impacts.
And you didn't see it as part of my...
The shifts, the three shifts you talked about?
You know, I do think that consumers, since the recession in particular, have become much more aware of how they're consuming. And this is absolutely backed up by a lot of the retailers that I speak with and the people that work in retailer, that there's more consciousness around what people are buying. I think it started with a simplicity movement, that people felt a little bit bloated and they wanted to streamline their life a little bit. I think it was exacerbated in a good way by the green movement, that people became aware of the impact of consumption on their environment. And then I think it was kind of hammered home with the recession, that in fact people wanted to preserve their personal economic resources as well. But I've definitely seen, absolutely without a doubt, a different sort of consumption. I have that in my book. I have more on this in other talks, but I don't think of it as defining psychological shift as some of these other ones. Certainly, I think people do look for purpose almost in a religious way through what they're purchasing today. And I see a big shift in that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Kit.
Hello.
I'll do the short question and the longer question. The short question is the global perspective on this, is sort of how this applies across mm-hmm. different continents. Because today, I purchased a couple of airline tickets from VietnamAirlines.com, and it was very difficult. And I called their San Francisco office and interacted with two different people, one of whom was, I think, I hope I'm not politically incorrect, but it was probably a communist from the day. And just bureaucracy, doesn't matter what you want. This is the bureaucracy. And I got through to another person who was, you could tell it was important to her to help me. And I'm not sure I got the best deal. I'm happy that I got the deal done. But I just want to know how all your five points really apply on a global perspective.
You know, I do all my primary research myself, so I do obviously use a lot of secondary research. I use tons and tons of other people's data. But the foundation of my research is actually my consumer interviews. And so since I want to do each one myself, that means I only interview in the U.S. So I don't in any way sort of suggest that my book can be translated globally. Although it has been translated into Russian, which is curious to me.
From your literature review, is there anything that implies similarity to what you're finding?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part.
Just from your review of the other literature, not your own research, but just the other literature.
Especially the technology. So I would say some of the other psychological shifts, maybe a little bit less. Like, for example, in Canada, there are only 50% of Canadians are anxious and the other half are okay. So I think we're probably one of the more anxious. But the technology, I think the effect of technology on how we relate to other people and how we think and what we want would be really universal in any culture that's using it.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. I think we got time for one more question.
I'm one of those Gen Y business owners in the fitness industry, which is a rather archaic industry as far as technovating, as you like to say. And I just wanted to get your opinion on selfies as a visual and how perhaps a more archaic industry can be using selfies as a visual and to make their brand even more powerful.
Well, I think you almost answered the question. It's an awesome idea. I mean, I think that if, in particular, people are seeing the benefits of your offering and they're showing that through photos that they're posting on Facebook or Instagram or Pinterest, you know, this is the testimonial that anybody needs. You know, look what it was before and now, look at, you know, or here's how much fun we're having, or here's my team, and, you know, we're doing this together. I mean, wow, that's, I don't think you can get any better than that. And as far as Technovating goes, there is no shortage of information about oneself available today, and there is no lack of interest in finding it out, whether it's our DNA or how many hours we slept or the effect of particular things on our body. We are into self-measurement and monitoring right now. So, you know, I would say you could probably, you know, add a little dose of technology and Technovation by incorporating a little bit more of their findings from their self-monitoring into your testimonials. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we are done. Do you want a formal ending? Here it comes. And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is now adjourned.